Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And this week, I'm going to be looking mainly at the origins of Italian fascism. And that really means that we have to go back into the 19th century and look at the process by which Italy was unified. And when I say unified, I think what we have to take into account is that perhaps Italy even today, apologies if there are indeed any Italian listeners, but perhaps Italy even today isn't what one would call a unified polity, a nation state. For more on arguments about what constitutes a polity or a nation state, look at Benedict Anderson's brilliant book, Imagined Communities. Superb. Italy in 1870 is geographically unified, but really, even on the eve of Mussolini's rise to power, the early 1920s, still there can't be seen to be a unified sense of Italian citizenship or nationhood. Italians are still divided geographically. Regional identities are still more important to many Italians than a sense of being national citizens. And for many Italians, particularly those in the poorer south and in Sicily, they feel they have little in common with people on the other side of the country. Now, if you examine the three founder figures of the Italian nation, Camillo Cavour, Giuseppe Garibaldi, and Mazzini, there are some clues here as to why this has occurred. Now, if we look at Cavour first, the Piedmontese Prime Minister, who was one of the leading forces behind unification, ultimately he didn't seek the unification of the entire Italian peninsula. That was a specific romantic vision that was held by the more romantic nationalists such as Garibaldi and Mazzini. Cavour himself was a Piedmontese expansionist. He saw the viability of a larger Piedmontese nation-state, which would take in some of the northern provinces of Italy and create a new, modern, industrialised state linked up with new innovations such as railways that would be part of the kind of the European club of new industrialising nations. Rather, not dissimilar in a way to Bismarck, who, far from being really the father of German unification, was really the father of Prussian expansionism that seems to result in German unification by 1871. So Cavour himself was not interested in the slightest in adding the impoverished southern half of Italy to the wealthy, prosperous north. And he had no interest in, when this finally does happen, of making any efforts to try to ameliorate the difference between north and south. Cavour himself wrote to Garibaldi and really asked him to curtail his activities. Garibaldi had been immensely successful in the south, invading and forcing out Austrian and Austrian proxy governments. And he had been immensely successful in leading revolutionary forces as a revolutionary nationalist to try to unify Italy. One of Cavour's worst nightmares is that this actually does happen. The south is liberated and then fused to the north in a combined nation state. The south If it's going to be a backwater, it should be a backwater on its own. I suppose one can look today to the problems that are being generated by taking powerhouse economies like Germany, for example, and weaker economies like Greece, and putting them under the same umbrella with the same currency, and really a combined political mechanism, when you've really got two completely different economies which have completely different needs and entirely different spending priorities. Anyway, that I digress. So you have a sense by the turn of the century that whilst Italy has been geographically unified, there's been no sense of political unification, and in large part the Catholic Church that was eventually forced to give up temporal power when Rome is incorporated into the new state never gives the majority Catholic population the indication that the new Italian state should have any backing or credence at all. The popes have a half-century-long sulk, in essence, until they sign an agreement with Mussolini. So there is no sense that the Italians are one people, that this political revolution has become a nationalist revolution that has formed national individuals, a sense of national patriotism and nationalist ardour. The proto-fascist Gabriel D'Annunzio was convinced of this fact and said that really something like fascism would have to come along in order to complete the process of national unification, of identifying the citizens with a strong centralised authoritarian state. But before we look at D'Annunzio, if we skip back and look at Mazzini and look at Garibaldi, there are also some important clues there. Now, both men were romantics, revolutionaries, nationalists, and Mazzini particularly was from that moment in European history up to 1848 when nationalism and liberalism very much went in hand. Why did they go hand in hand? Well, because the great enemy to the nationalists of places such as Poland and Italy and Hungary and many of these countries that desired to have a national unification moment or a liberation moment were the old empires such as Austria and Russia. And therefore, liberalism was a way of articulating nationalist desires by also articulating this desire for a kind of a limited state, a constitutional state, a constitutional monarch, and an end to absolutism. If you were a Pole or an Italian, you knew all about the wrongs of absolutism in the first half of the 19th century. The failure of the revolutions of 1848, particularly in Italy, where Pope Pius IX decides that he's not going to back the revolution, and subsequently it fails, and the Austrians manage to overthrow the revolutionary states quite easily, it signals an end to really the liberal notions of nationalism, and nationalism, not as in a kind of a causational way, particularly, though there is a limited amount of causation there, but nationalism tends in the second half of the 19th century to swing in a more reactionary direction. Therefore, the state that would be created after a national revolution in, let's say, Italy or Poland or what have you, would perhaps be more reactionary, more authoritarian, less liberal. And the Mazzinian dream of young Italy really dies after 1848. But many of the romantic ideas about the nation and the nation state continue. So we now have these threads of authoritarianism and romanticism existing within this new nationalism. And these are prime ingredients for fascism, which really needs the kind of the crucible of the First World War to really help form it. I say form. I always look upon fascism as being less of a kind of a coherent set of doctrines like Marxism, and more of a kind of an umbrella of sort of related and sometimes contradictory ideas, and a sort of like a mishmash of more kind of notions. It's very sort of an idea that speaks to the emotion as opposed to the intellect. So the Romanticism of which I speak was part of the European 19th century Romantic movement, which had tendencies towards fascism. It's unfair to say that Romantics were fascists. It's completely illogical, because obviously fascism didn't exist when Romantic painters, writers and poets were writing. But many fascists do draw their inspiration from Romanticism. And Romanticism said many things, far too many to kind of catalogue here. But in broad brushstrokes, there was a sense that the encroaching modern world was quite an alienating, frightening and dangerous thing, as evidenced by the Industrial Revolution. And the response, the logic in the Romantic poets and writers and artists of Europe was to harken back for a kind of a seemingly more innocent time, a time of kind of more moral and spiritual purity in some sort of imagined aspect of the Middle Ages. One which obviously kind of doesn't feature kind of cholera and European wars and things like that. And back then, one could find the true essence of humanity. And the Italian fascists would, of course, look back to far back beyond the Middle Ages, to the classical era, to ancient Rome, and to classicism itself, when the art, the sculptors, the giganticism of classicism can obviously be seen all around Rome and in all across Italy, the sculpture and the artwork of the Renaissance and also of the ancient world, emphasized masculinity and strength and a certain notion of kind of nobility, grace, strength and power. It's no wonder that Hitler also embraces neoclassicism as an art form, and Arno Brecker, his favorite sculptor, created works of art such as Readiness, the naked sort of David character with a sword, and is this kind of armed colossus, perfectly sculpted as an idealized image of masculinity. Fascism, there are lots of kind of themes within both Romanticism and fascism of masculinity in crisis and something needing to be done to arrest this kind of gradual emasculation of man through the modern world and through the possibility of mass democracy, obviously with women getting the vote and things like that. Fascisms in Germany and Italy were both renowned for then drawing their inspiration from the past and looking into the past to find solutions to contemporary problems. But fascism is a very modernist idea as well. Fascism also has this strange duality, this strange contradiction that's never quite reconciled. That's because the whole fascist ideas are never particularly well articulated. Of dynamism, of thrusting forward into the future. If you look at some of the Italian futurists, painters who are just creating work on the eve of World War I and thereafter, particularly those of Marinetti, there is a sense of, and the futurists were all fascists, by the way, there is a sense of the oncoming future of technology and the modern world and the energies that it can bring driving mankind forward. And the reason why this was attractive to fascists is because a question had been weighing heavily on the minds of people like D'Annunzio, really, since the 1890s, I imagine, that ultimately, what is to be done to salvage the individual in the modern era? Two threatening trends are coming. Firstly, Marxism and socialism. The rise of the socialist movement across Europe, even long before 1917, long before the Russian Revolution, where the first communist government is installed, there is a sense of dread amongst the middle classes and the upper classes, and kind of the lower middle classes too, about the constant march of democratic socialist and undemocratic socialist parties across Europe. And also, to head off this, what governments were doing, bit by bit, some more so than others, Britain being the leading example, and Italy probably not so much, was offering the franchise, was enfranchising the working classes, giving them the vote, to take the steam, take the strength out.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
...of revolutionary tensions that were emerging across Europe. And in doing so, they hoped that they could bring the majority of their populations into the political mainstream, and by and large it works. But it works to the detriment, really, of traditional elites who find that they ultimately lose power, which is a damn sight nicer than, you know, losing your head in a revolution, and that there is the rise of new working class politics. So fascism posits this question of, well, in an age where everyone has the vote, or possibly in a future where the workers rule, what is there? Where do these romantic values fit in? Where does strength and leadership and heroism and courage and masculinity and all these things, where do they fit in? And the answer is, well, they don't. So fascism postulates this further solution to the dilemmas of the modern world. And this is with, really, if we're going to talk about the role of the individual, well, we only need to be talking about one individual, a leader, an inspired leader, heroic leader, a Nietzschean Superman, if you will. And that leader will understand things on a level that the masses just can't. He will be able to lead the ordinary man through the many perils of the modern world, the many kind of economic, social and political problems he's just not capable of grasping. And this leader will be able to act decisively. And this leader will be warlike as well. Because ultimately, one of the romantic ideas that the fascists really liked was that war is the test of manhood, and that war is the thing that will help to forge this Italian nation. And that the thing that Italy has in fact lacked, that would make it into a nation state, is war. Now, there is a lot of evidence to suggest that Britain's experience of two world wars in the 20th century has forged a certain sense of British identity. But it's not a given that war is a kind of a healthy tonic for a disunified polity. And certainly in Italy's case, it definitely wasn't. Now, Italian fascism isn't necessarily overtly racial all the time. In fact, only in 1938 does Italian fascism embrace anti-Semitism. And this is really as a kind of a sop to Hitler, because Hitler's the Nazi anti-Semitism is radicalising on the eve of war, and Hitler and Mussolini, their diplomatic ties, for reasons too lengthy to go into in this podcast, are strengthening in 1938. So Mussolini has to keep pace. But the Italians, to their credit, had a fairly impressive record of not handing over Jews to the Nazis during World War II. And it's only really in 1943 when Germany officially occupies a large portion of Italy do Jews wind up being mass transported to Auschwitz on the transports. So with fascism, whilst many fascisms do embrace an anti-Semitism or a racial aspect to them, Nazism is slightly anomalous amongst these fascisms in that it has a specific, almost quasi-scientific, I say scientific with inverted commas, scientific aspect to its racial argument. Many of the fascisms, such as Croat fascism with the Ustasche during World War II, are really a kind of a Catholic anti-Semitism, a sort of like a medieval religious anti-Semitism, as opposed to a kind of a biological sort of quasi-cod Darwinist anti-Semitism. And Mussolini doesn't really go in for any of that, but I think Mussolini's race crimes really are perpetrated against places such as Abyssinia. Abyssinia is invaded in 1935. Mussolini is happy to eradicate the tribesmen with poison gas and other such horrific tools of war. And whilst, you know, there is no overt racial doctrine articulated, one might argue that the subjugation of poor African tribesmen is an inherently racial crime. Now, it's a common thing for people to write in their essays that World War I creates fascism. In many ways, it does. But there are pitfalls with this, and this is one of the things I want to talk about today. Firstly, all these ideas are in common circulation before World War I. They are articulated by people like D'Annunzio, who is the kind of the poet laureate of Italy before World War I. He is a celebrated figure. People view some of his more fascist outpourings, not that it's called fascism at the time, but some of his more fascist outpourings, as curious eccentricities of an otherwise loved national treasure. So these ideas are already there. Secondly, most of our kind of analyses about World War I and the origins of extremism are pertain to the defeated side. So you look at Germany and, yes, the Treaty of Versailles and the shock defeat, stab in the back, etc., etc. That goes some way to explaining the appeal of Hitler's rhetoric. But Italy isn't on the defeated side. Italy is on the side of the victors. Italy has suffered horrifically during the war. Italy has 1 million war dead, and there's a number of shaming defeats, such as the Battle of Caporetto and the struggle in the Alpines against the Austrians. By the way, a very good book on this subject is Mark Thompson's The White War. Well worth reading, and that articulates many of the wartime roots of fascism. Very, very good. So Italy has had this horrific wartime experience, which has put almost unbearable strain on an already struggling economy and unbearable social tensions on Italian society. And the payoff that the Italians hope for are the irredental lands, places such as Dalmatia and Trieste and chunks of the Tyrolese Alps. But this doesn't happen. Italy is very, in her view, very poorly rewarded at the Treaty of Versailles and doesn't get very much at all. Now, the reason why this is relevant is because, once again, war was seen on the far right as being this test of the nation state, this unifying, forging moment for the nation state. And what happens at the end of it? Italy is treated like an irrelevance at the Treaty of Versailles and really laughed out of town by Lloyd George, Clemenceau, Wilson, and a variety of other European leaders. The Italians eventually storm out in disgust, and the Big Four become, with Orlando, become the Big Three. So Italy is not seen as being a credible player on the international scene, despite this heroic sacrifice for the nation state. And the way the fascists would later on look at Italy's war record was precisely that, that it were that war had been this martyrdom, that it wasn't a case of hundreds of thousands of fairly reluctant Italian soldiers who were really peasants and workers being sent to the front line. But the sons of Italy were dying in huge numbers in order to create a better, greater Italy, an imperial Italy, if you will. And this romantic view really is a kind of an echo of the world view, the world that perhaps people like Garibaldi wished had existed, where there were these, you know, keen and enthusiastic people willing to lay down their lives for Italy first and the individual second. Well, it's just fantasy. There is no sense of Italian nationhood quite like that. There are periods in time, perhaps Russia during World War II, where there is this profound sense of noble martyrdom, and people do definitely engage in it and fight to the death for the glory of the motherland. But the Italians really don't have that particularly at all. So even though Italy is on the winning side, the Treaty of Versailles is one of the radicalising moments for Italian fascism, because everything that Italy is supposed to have obtained through war, not just imperial conquest, but a strong sense of herself and a strong sense of patriotic pride for ordinary Italians, where they can buy in and become members of this kind of national state, nation state or national community, all members of the same tribe, all rejoicing in the same victory, doesn't exist. The other product of the war is obviously communism. The Russian Revolution in 1917 has repercussions far beyond the Russian border, and it radicalises anti-communism in every state in Europe. There are even anti-communist sort of quasi-fascist squads in places as far away as Australia in the 1920s and 30s. In 1919 and 1920, the two red years, the Biennio Rosso, was a time of acute fear for Italian landowners and business owners and Italy's middle class, and the sense that something horrific was about to take place in Italy could only be underlined by looking to the north and looking to Russia and seeing that there was a savage civil war ongoing with countless accounts of atrocities and bloodshed and murder going on assuming in the European press on an almost daily or weekly basis. So fascism has an immense appeal after World War One in it being a clear counter to the threat of communism. And the Squadristi performed a duty that was quite similar to that performed by the mafiosi in the 19th century of dealing with uppity local socialists or troublemakers. In 19th century Sicily, the local mafiosi were the people landowners would turn to if they had a problem with peasants that were demanding higher pay rises or stepping out of line in some way. So the Squadristi perform this valuable function, and there are obviously, as you can see with the murder of Matteotti later on, very strong connections between the fascists and the mob. Anyway, that's all for me for today. I hope that's been useful and has shown you a bit of the wider historical context of the roots of fascism. Because fascism is this kind of extraordinary phenomena that springs forth. And it's got to have some interesting and perhaps complex origins. So if you're going to be writing about this in your exam papers, if you're writing about Italian fascism, always make sure that when you're introducing a line of argument in your introduction, and if you don't know about that, go back through these podcasts, and there's a whole, several audios on lines of argument. When you are introducing a line of argument, make sure that you're giving it this kind of contextual basis. You're showing where fascism is coming from, but don't waffle on. Examiners hate that. Anyway, look forward to catching you on the next podcast. And if you are stuck for something interesting to read, the new explaining history writer, Dr. Chris Kostov, his brilliant The Communist Century is out now for e-reader, Kindle, and all related devices. It's absolutely fantastic, well worth dipping your nose into, and it's a brilliant roundup of communism in the 20th century made accessible for students, for enthusiasts, and people that just want to know more. So check it out on the Explaining History website, that's www.explaininghistory.com, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. Thanks very much, bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards. Save